This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik. Movember may be coming to an end, but it's always important to talk about men's health issues. Now, many men may be too shy to talk about their sexual problems, but these are health conditions that can be treated just by seeking proper medical advice from a health professional, a doctor. So we have one very such doctor in the studio with us today, Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam, a consultant urologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center, and we'll be discussing some of the common male sexual dysfunctions and how to manage them. So if you have any questions, as I'm sure you will, call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, Dr. Siva. How are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm well. Thank you.
Dr. Siva, before we start talking about what's abnormal in terms of a man's sexual function, let's talk about what's actually normal. How would you describe normal male sexual function?
Okay. Without getting too technical, I'd probably state that normal sexual function is basically a complex bodily process that involves both physiological as well as psychological mechanisms in the human body. Sexual function basically is said to go through five different stages. It's typically described as the desire, which is usually psychological urges, mm-hmm. thoughts and fantasies. Then you have the arousal phase. In the case of a man, it would represent penile erection, increased general muscle tone, increased heart rate, respiratory rate. And then you have the plateau stage, which is when one has an impending sensation of euphoric sexual release. And then, of course, you have the actual orgasm itself, which is in men, again, characterized by ejaculation. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you have the resolution phase, which is the terminal or end phase of the five stages that I described, whereby the psychological and physiological state is in more towards a state of relaxation, mm-hmm. And the person's genital tissues are refractory and are no longer amenable to any further arousal or orgasm.
Okay, very, very clinical terms to describe. What is a very natural, normal human function, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, of these five stages and it's as you say, very complex. It's a complex physiological involving psychological processes as well. So I guess it could be at any point of these processes and stages where something could go wrong and that would lead to a disruption in the normal function. Could you give us an idea of what could go wrong with these processes?
Okay. Now, if you're looking at the various components that control human sexual function in men, we are basically reliant on the vascular system. We are reliant on the neurological system, on nerve function. We are reliant on hormones. And again, not to run away from the main thing, we are also reliant on the psychological state of that particular individual. So a disruption or an imbalance in any one of these, let me just give you an example. If a person has got problems with penile blood flow, for example, now that could lead to very easily a kind of very commonly known sexual problem, which is erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if a person has got an abnormal venous leak from the penis, they again would have difficulty sustaining an erection during sexual intercourse and again leading to erectile dysfunction. Besides that, there are also hormonal causes. For example, some men suffer from low testosterone level. Sometimes they might even have thyroid function imbalances, which could be contributing to erectile dysfunction. Now, mm-hmm. When we look at all these disruptions, we would usually like to categorize them in order to get an understanding of what kind of a problem or where the clues to the problem might lie. So we typically either categorize them as something being lifelong. In other words, the person never had a normal quote-unquote sexual experience to something which is acquired, where they have moved from a position of normal sexual functioning to a problem. And then the other part is looking at whether this is something that is a generalized thing or situational thing, because sometimes we encounter men, for example, who have no difficulty absolutely whatsoever trying to get an erection when they're on their own self-stimulating. But when they are with their partners, they are unable to.
They have problems.
Yes.
Okay. So in a case like that, in actually in any situation, no matter what is the cause or the circumstances, how do you do your investigative work there?
Okay. The risk of sounding very traditional, it actually comes with actually spending a bit of time. It's a bit of a different consultation to maybe some of the other disease conditions that I manage as a urologist, where this actually requires more time to elicit. It's almost like playing the role of a psychologist, as it were. Although I'm not a trained psychologist, you can't rush these things through because it's often very, even for men who come to the clinic expecting treatment or advice, it's not very easy for them at times to open to discussing very personal matters regarding their sex life. So it does take a bit of a time trying to gain their confidence first, but it comes through conversation, reassuring as much as you can that they're not on their own. Mm-hmm. We need to look at what the problems are. Perhaps the problem can be reversed, if not fully, maybe partially, and giving them a little bit of a hope when you're conducting. So it starts with basically an interview process, you would inquire not only into the specific sexual problems, but you would also extend beyond that to their general health. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of times we find that the underlying medical condition or maybe there is a medical condition that is yet to be uncovered in them could be manifesting itself as sexual problems.
Right. Okay.
So we need to go out a little bit more than just sexual functioning as well. And then there are some cursory physical examinations that we would do in the clinic. And then beyond that, when we come towards testing, doing objective tests, there are blood tests, for example, hormone panels and things like that, which will again help us to get the answers. Because one of the things that we always realize is even if the complaint is the same, no two men will have exactly the same underlying process that has resulted in them having the sexual dysfunction. So trying to tease that out is what comes with basically the history, the examination, and also to a certain extent relying on investigative tests that are done in medical centers.
I mean, how open are men to talking about these with their healthcare professional? And I would assume that if they're in your clinic, they've actually recognized it as a medical condition that they're seeking treatment, as you've said. But what kind of changes have you seen in you know, whether the taboo of talking about male sexual conditions has reduced?
I think one of the things that I've observed, because I've had the opportunity to practice in this field here and in another country abroad, and what I've noticed is there are still a lot of perils, even with Western society. Even we talk about Western society being very open, et cetera, et cetera. But somehow sex is still something not very easy to bridge, to consider it
Absolutely.
A problem, to talk about it. Mm-hmm. It's easy, not just in the context of dysfunction, but even in context of normal function.
Mm-hmm.
So generally what I've noticed in the West is usually when the men come, we always notice that the female partner is a lot more proactive, and it's generally basically because they've been actually advised by their partners, you know, come to the clinic, and most of the time they do accompany their partners as well.
Mm.
The context is slightly different in Malaysia because I think a lot has to do with their own sort of like comfort level, where they feel comfortable talking about sex. And because they know when they go into a doctor with this complaint, there is going to be some difficult conversations that they will need to have with the healthcare professional. So, but I generally find that most of the patients who are seeking medical advice usually tend to be perhaps more onto open-minded. Maybe they're more educated, tertiary level education. Most of them tend to be younger. Mm-hmm. So they're a bit concerned, you know, I'm in my 20s and 30s and I have this problem. What's the bearing going to be for the rest of your life?
Right.
Don't tend to get that many so-called senior citizens coming and seeking medical advice specifically for sexual dysfunction. That's what I've observed in the time that I've been here.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that men have a tendency to accept the loss or reduction of sexual function as a normal part of aging? And should it be?
Yeah, I think you're spot on by saying that, because I think there is a certain kind of feeling that, you know, as you age, you know, and you get to a certain age in your golden years, then, you know, sex is no longer an important part of one's life. Mm. And sometimes I think a lot of this may also be related to what their partners are going through. For example, the male partner may have intent or desire, but it's not sometimes reciprocated by their female partner for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. There could be a lot of reasons behind that. So I think that aspect of it definitely does play a role. So there's more of a general acceptance that if you reach a certain age, it's not a big part of your life anymore, and you know, you can afford to do without it. But what I would like to try to emphasize or address is that is not something that is universally applicable. Because right. What I feel is there are some men, indeed some couples, who may be in their golden years who still want to remain sexually active. And I think whatever encouragement and help which we can give as healthcare professionals, I think we should extend it to them and not be so age biased, as it were.
Okay, that's right. And actually, on that note, extending beyond the idea of whether sex should be a priority when you're older, but there's also the fact that, as you said, some of these the sexual dysfunctions are symptoms or the manifestation of underlying health conditions that may not even have been picked up yet. So that's a very good reason for a man to not try to sweep it under the carpet or the bed sheets, as it were. And that's something that I'd like to explore a little further, the link between specifically erectile dysfunction and certain chronic conditions, heart disease. And we'll also go into some of the other common types of male sexual dysfunctions. So Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam, consultant urologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center, is in the studio with us. If you have any questions to ask about male sexual dysfunctions, male sexual problems, you can call us 03-7733-2900. If you're a little bit shy, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm T. Shao-Ik. In the studio with me today, Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam, consultant urologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center. We are discussing male sexual dysfunction. If you have any questions for Dr. Siva, you can call us 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Siva, we've talked a little bit about erectile dysfunction, which is, I think, the most well-known, one of the more common types of male sexual problems. Can you give us an idea of what are some of the other conditions that bring patients to your clinic?
Okay. The other thing that we do commonly address or see in our clinical practice is basically ejaculatory dysfunctions or ejaculatory problems. Now, this actually consists of a heterogeneous group of conditions, and I think something that probably most men have heard of or can maybe personally relate to is probably premature ejaculation. But there is also the opposite spectrum, where men sometimes have difficulty ejaculating or have delayed ejaculation. And you can also have a situation where there's retrograde ejaculation or even failure to achieve orgasm. But I'd say among all this...
Yes. Retrograde meaning?
Retrograde meaning that the individual is able to ejaculate, but they either have very low seminal fluid expressed or sometimes none at all.
Right. Okay. All right. And so that covers, ejaculation problems is a big umbrella term that covers what could be quite a range of problems. What about, and I suppose this would relate to perhaps the more psychological aspects, libido and desire problems. Okay. How common are those?
Decreased libido, it can be a problem on its own, in the sense that it can be a primary problem which relates to the patient having either persistent or recurrent deficient thoughts on sex, sexual fantasies, and so on and so forth. Or there are also possibilities where it actually arises as a secondary to other problems which they've had. For example, a person suffering from prolonged difficulties with erectile dysfunction or even premature ejaculation, they with time can develop decreased interest in sex or libido. Causality-wise, you're right. There are psychological factors which can trigger decreased libido. But equally important, there are also hormonal factors which can influence, chief being having low testosterone. And again, this can be part of aging process where they have a decline in testosterone, or sometimes we do have even middle-aged men who have reduced testosterone production. And this sometimes can lead, amongst other problems, to low libido.
Okay. Over on WhatsApp, we have a question from Darth Vader, who wants to know what causes premature ejaculation, which is one of the ejaculation problems you mentioned earlier. Sure. And are there any medical remedies? As there are a lot of so-called products out there, like, you know, enhanced medicines or creams or sprays that can delay ejaculation.
Yeah. As far as causality of premature ejaculation is concerned, I mean, there are a lot of theories about whether it's neurological, whether it's psychological. Those who come from probably more of a psychosexual therapy point of view, those who are more of therapists from psychology, would probably relate to premature ejaculation as a sort of a inappropriate learned behavior. And what I mean by that is the kind of learned behavior I'm referring to is probably self-stimulation or masturbation, which men do in their younger years. And as you can imagine, it's something that they do over a long period of time. So it becomes kind of a learned habit because we have to accept that what a man experiences when he's self-stimulating himself is completely very different to having a partnered relationship. So in that context, that sort of mal-learned behavior contributes to them not being able to sustain their erection in a normal intercourse.
All right.
In terms of treatment, there are pharmaceutical treatments that are available. When you're talking about topical things, they typically contain local anesthetic agents, which numbs the sensory portion of the genitalia. Mm-hmm. So they are able to not achieve orgasm so soon.
Right. Okay.
Because there are also tablet medications that men now can take, these can be taken on demand. It's not something they need to be on every day, but it's something they will typically take maybe an hour or 3 hours before they decide to have sex. Mm-hmm. And both of them have good effect. But generally, what I will advise and men who are suffering from premature ejaculation is it has to be a concerted approach of using medicine and perhaps an element of psychotherapy as well. And this is what works best for them. And there are experts in this field, psychologists and psychotherapists who are able to help men. And sometimes it's a question of them undoing what they had learned as their sexual experiences in younger life.
But is that a lifelong condition?
This goes back to what I was saying. It sometimes can be something that's acquired, and sometimes it can be something that's lifelong. So lifelong in the sense that they've always had a problem since, you know, when they became sexually aware and they started being sexually active. Sometimes it can be also acquired. And acquired, this is where perhaps a traumatic experience, maybe a difficult relationship, things like that can trigger them to have a lack of confidence with sexual intercourse, and then they end up manifesting problems of premature ejaculation.
Okay. Another question from AA on WhatsApp. It's related to completely, is a curved penis caused by trauma reversible? And AA also wants to know, is Peyronie's disease the main cause of a curved penis, or are there other common causes?
Okay. When you're talking about having a problem with the curvature of the penis, obviously from a physical point of view, what we would normally need to see is whether the deformity or the curvature is actually affecting the rigidity of the penis. And the second thing is whether the angulation or the extent of the deformity is affecting one from having penetrative intercourse. So these are things that we will normally want to assess. And the reason why this is important is basically the kind of treatment that you're going to advise patients would depend on it. In the event you have someone who has got a very significant curvature of the penis, and this is also associated with a flaccid penis where the penis is not rigid enough for penetrative intercourse, then typically the best treatment for this individual would be to actually undergo surgery, where they would undergo an implant placement in their penis. But if we are just talking about a slight deformity of the penis where the rigidity is not in any way affected, and otherwise they're able to, you know, have a firm, hard penis, sometimes corrective surgery can be done on the penis to correct the extent of the deformity.
Okay.
And there are various techniques that can be employed to correct the deformity.
Right. So the first thing you're looking for is how it affects function.
Correct.
You know, but if in a situation where it doesn't actually affect function, but I suppose there's, again, a psychological aspect to how it looks. How would you talk a patient through that?
I think the first thing is to reassure things, because what people generally see in media and, you know, even when you're talking about pornography, that sometimes is not something that is reflective of what the everyday or average Joe has. So even when you're talking about penis, it's normal for men to have some degree of deviation in their penis. And there can be various reasons why this had happened. Sometimes it can be due to underlying disease. For example, if they've had infections, traumas to the penis, and there was fibrosis, scar formation, they could end up with that. Or they could have had some, sometimes it could be even as a result of a traumatic sexual experience. There is a condition called penile fracture. So something like that, when that heals, could potentially result in not only erectile dysfunction, but sometimes even penile deformity as well. So I think the key thing is to look at it from a functional point of view. So what I normally do is I advise patients on reassurance. It's normal not to have an absolutely straight penis.
What is the so-called ideal?
Ideal. And the key thing is it impairing the person's function? And if it is impairing, in what way? Is it because the angulation is so deviated that it's impossible to penetrate to normal positions? Or we are talking about where the deviation has caused the penis to be too soft at certain parts and make it buckle during intercourse?
Right, okay. But it is also asking about, you know, Peyronie's disease.
Peyronie's disease is basically a disease or a condition which causes fibrosis either in the lining or the surface of the tissue that covers the erectile spongiosum tissue, or sometimes you can even have fibrosis within the spongiosa tissue. Spongiosa tissue is basically the tissue that accumulates blood during sexual arousal. So there are many conditions. One of the common things that we see patients with Peyronie's do tend to have is diabetes. So that's something that we do see quite often. And again, trauma can also result. Previous trauma can be a cause of Peyronie's disease. So it basically refers to curvature or fibrosis of the penile tissue, which results in curvature, basically.
But with diabetes, it's also linked to erectile dysfunction.
Correct.
It a complication of diabetes?
Yes, you can regard it as a complication. And sometimes you could even, at times, even say maybe it's an early warning as well of somebody going to have, who's going to potentially get diabetes. That's where I think what we were going back to earlier, we shouldn't look at a man's sexual dysfunction in isolation as just being that component of the person's life, but rather look at it as a marker of general health. So here we are not just looking at physical health, but also looking at the individual's mental health as well. So definitely seeking medical advice with this problem would definitely entail having, in the start, a bit of a global workup to see where the problems lie, what could cause. And yes, diabetes is one of the commonest causes for erectile dysfunction because just like how it affects coronary vessels, it has a negative impact on the inner lining or the endothelial cells of the blood vessels. So you do get, just as how you get clogging of arteries in the heart, you can also get clogging of arteries that supply the penis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you see a patient with erectile dysfunction, you're going to be looking at heart function, you're going to be looking at glucose levels.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, how... I guess, how often do you find that the erectile dysfunction is actually masking these underlying chronic diseases that need, you know, a completely whole different set of treatment?
I wouldn't be able to put a specific percentage or figure in it, but generally, when we do go through the process of assessing someone for sexual dysfunction, we do tend to unmask certain symptoms that the patients may have. For example, maybe being a bit breathless when they're going upstairs, or maybe even getting more out of wind even when they're having sex, for example. And that leads to a clue where you might be considering maybe there might be some cardiological or cardiac dysfunction or impairment there, and then it allows you to do further investigations on them to see what is their physical capacity. Has that reduced what they are normally able to carry out? Like if they're playing sports, have they stopped that because of their getting breathless? Have they experienced any chest pain? So it kind of sort of spreads out from that initial consultation. So as you get feedback from the patient on what's going on, you also get the opportunity to ask more focused questions regarding their general health. And it would be useful also to ask a patient if they've gone for a general checkup before. And if it's been a long interval, then it's perhaps an opportune time for them to actually consider going for a general checkup as part of that visit. Like, for example, getting blood tests. And normally, you wouldn't expect to come to a urologist and maybe think, oh, should I get my fasting lipids checked or should I get my fasting glucose checked? But I think because the condition actually is a barometer, it reflects more things than just sexual function. I always advise patients, they give it up to them, their options, but I always tell them that there could be other reasons why you're manifesting these problems. And it would be a missed opportunity if someone didn't walk you through that process to look into those things. If it's all clear, then all good. It's well, then we have less problems to worry about. But if it is, at least we're picking it up early.
Does age matter?
To a certain extent, this is very, very generalization. Now, if you talk about erection problems, generally, the younger patients do tend to have more of a psychological element behind why they're experiencing erectile dysfunction. And as you get older, when they have other medical disorders associated with them, generally it tends to be a part of a spectrum of other conditions.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Because the reason I asked that also is it related to erectile dysfunction. If you saw, say, a 20-something-year-old patient with ED, would you be inclined to ask him to investigate his heart health and all that? Or would you think that's perhaps more suited for an older
What I would probably do is before resorting to doing very specialized tests, then what I would probably do in my questioning of the patient or getting a bit of background details, I would inquire into their state of function, because that generally, I mean, although it's not a very precise tool, but it generally gives, I mean, if a person's still very active playing sports, etc., and all that, then your index of suspicion may not be as high. Of course, it can be still an option given to them, but as I said, it's you probably would want to spend more time talking about the psychological aspects of why they could have had that as opposed to having medical conditions. Again, when you do take medical history from a person, you also are inquiring into their family history as well.
Yes.
Now, if someone is coming from a very strong family history of heart disease, diabetes, dyslipidemia, and all that, and age may not be such a big discriminator anymore. In other words, you don't say, oh, you're young, so you shouldn't have the test. If there's a very strong family history, then you discuss it with the patient, say, look, you know, you're young, but it could be that this is a manifestation of that. And you should probably at your time, although you're not symptomatic from a heart point of view or from a physical point of view with regards to exertion, you should probably get yourself checked. Maybe go for an ECG or something like that.
Okay. We are talking about male sexual dysfunctions with Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam. consultant urologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center. We've got a few questions on WhatsApp, which I'll get to after the next break. So if you want to keep sending those through, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also call us 03-7733-2900 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back after this quick, these few messages and a market update. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam, consultant urologist from Ara Damansara Medical Center. We are discussing male sexual dysfunctions, common ones such as erectile dysfunction, ejaculation problems. We've even covered curved penis as perhaps some of the problems that you may be experiencing. If you have any questions, you can call us 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've had a few questions come in on WhatsApp, so I'm going to address that some of those, Dr. Siva. One is, how do we address penile dysmorphism? Is there any sort of normal size range established for penile length and girth in Malaysia?
I'm probably a little bit out of my depth here with regards to knowing what the average length in the Asian population is going to be here. But if I recall, there was actually a study or a poll, I think it was done by Durex. I'm not quite sure whether I've got my facts here right, where they talked about what the average penile length is in various parts of the world. I think in Asian countries, I can't say specifically Malaysian context, but I think you're probably looking at somewhere around 8 to 9 centimeters being sort of like an average kind of length. But, you know, as I said, the key thing is we usually can't do much with respect to that with what we are born or genetically inherited with. So the question is, I think, rather than sort of being absolutely obsessed with the quantity, the length or the girth, it's more, I think, what we should be talking about is quality. How satisfied are we really in our sex lives? I think that should be the bigger question rather than being absolutely obsessing about size and length.
Mm. Is penile dysmorphism something that drives men to your clinic?
Interestingly, in my practice, no. I would probably say I've seen some, which I've seen in conjunction with my pediatric colleagues, where sometimes parents get unduly worried, especially with prepubescent boys. And they feel concerned that maybe their son may end up with a very, very small, non-functioning penis. That's what they think in their mind anyway. Then usually it just requires them some reassurance, because you won't really get to know your actual penile length until you're probably around 16, 18, you know, when you're way past your pubertal spurt. So my patients that I've seen so far, they have tended to not particularly complain about, but that's maybe the way, you know, my practice is. But I've not come across, but I've seen parents bring children's, the pediatric context.
Interestingly. Yeah, we have Kumar on the line with a question. Good afternoon, Kumar.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question, Kumar?
Question number one is, how do you overcome this ED problem?
Yes, okay.
And then number two is, the medication as regard to the Viagra, can a normal person take it if he has a certain age but not having a problem with diabetic and blood pressure? Maybe he want to enjoy it for a longer time. Or does he have to take a complete tablet or quarter of it or half of it?
All right. Thank you very much, Kumar, for your question.
Okay, I think maybe I'll answer the second part of his question first regarding the dosage of one of the medications that was commonly prescribed for erectile dysfunction, sildenafil or Viagra. I think his first part of the question was, can he still take it if he doesn't have any underlying medical illnesses?
Diabetes or...
And I'm assuming he's referring to recreational intake of the medication, opposed to having erectile dysfunction and taking it. There are some contraindications to taking all types of medications, and this is phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor medication. That's where Viagra and sildenafil comes from. The main thing being is they should not be taking any medications which fall under the big category of nitrates, which are typically cardiac drugs. The main reason why this is ill-advised is there is a potential risk for precipitous drop in their blood pressure if they take it concomitantly. And in fact, patients who have taken medicines such as Viagra, if they ever do go into the emergency department of any hospital and they're seeking medical advice, maybe they're unwell, they should make it a point to have informed the attending doctor that they had consumed the drug. Because sometimes certain medications may be given. Like, for example, they could be using the drug, they may have had chest pain. So they might suspect that the patient may have had a small heart attack or maybe an impending heart attack. Mm-hmm. Some of the medications that they might give in the emergency room can actually make things worse for the patient. So I think the main contraindication, which I think which is already clearly explicitly mentioned in the product literature as well, is consumption of concomitant nitrates. That's what it's contraindicated. Now, with regards to using it recreationally, to enhance one's sexual performance, what for a person with no erectile dysfunction, the only thing that a PDE5 type inhibitor drug is probably going to do is enhance, in the sense that it's probably going to reduce the refractory period, when I was referring to the stages mm-hmm. of sexual function. Mm-hmm. So they can perhaps recover their erection after orgasm a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about getting supra-physiological erection, that's something beyond and above what their blood vessels are capable of delivering, mm-hmm. that's not probably going to be something realistic. Although people have that expectation when they take, but mm-hmm. what it does help with is if they intend to have multiple encounters during the night, and obviously the refractory period is going to be a lot shorter mm-hmm. if they take PDE5 inhibitor. With respect to its dosage question, there are two schools of thought. There are some who would advise, as clinicians, for the patient to take the lower dose and gradually build up. And there are some who are like myself. If I know the medication is safe and I'm dealing with a person who is understanding of what we're trying to achieve, I normally start my patients on the higher dose and titrate downwards.
Okay.
Now, the rationale for me doing it the opposite way is basically, by the time men come and seek medical advice for erectile dysfunction, it's usually been a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of, they need some good news, and they need good news fast. So what we tend to do is we tend to give the best chance for the medication to work. And we try to give the higher dose. And then as the men start to get the confidence and they start to see the medication work for them, we ask themselves to self-titrate from going from the one whole tablet to a half a tablet, and then monitoring whether they're able to maintain the erection. But I think if the individual who had written in or called in rather Kumar feels that he's actually noticing an improvement in his quality of erection with and without the medication, then he could potentially actually be having a degree of erectile dysfunction already. Mm. And what I would like to emphasize is, although, we don't condone using the medication for recreational use, but if he's really finding good effect with the drug, he should probably get himself checked, because he may be having early manifestation of erectile dysfunction.
And then if you have questions about dosage, the doctor is the right person
to
manage that, right?
Exactly.
Robotan, you have a question.
Hello, doctor. I have two questions here.
Yes.
How long does a normal sexual intercourse last? And the second question is, can masturbation cause hiatus hernia?
Okay, thank you very much, Robert. We'll address that on air.
Okay. Mr. Robotan, with regards to what you've asked, how long is a normal sexual experience? Now, what you're asking basically, if you're looking for a very specific definition, I think you probably have to take the definition from what we classify as premature ejaculation. So when we talk about premature ejaculation, I think what our literature and what our professional body says is someone who experiences ejaculation within a minute of having penetrative intercourse.
Okay.
So if you are saying, you know, how long should sexual intercourse last, I would rather probably answer it the other way. It shouldn't be shorter than a minute.
Okay.
So anything beyond that, that basically depends on the person's individual practice, what they do, and, you know, their experience level and how the partner engages with them and so on and so forth. So I don't think you can call us a norm.
And again, it comes back to what you said earlier. Don't take what you see in the movies or whatever this idea of what's perfect.
Absolutely.
Robert had a second question. Yeah. Can masturbation cause hiatus hernia?
Okay. A very interesting question, of which I see two different aspects here. Because, I mean, obviously masturbation we know is basically self-gratification by stimulating the genitalia. Now, the second part of his question, he's asking whether there's any link to that and hiatus hernia. And hiatus hernia is something that affects the gastrointestinal system, where you basically suffer from reflux. I mean, if I follow what he specifically said, hiatus hernia. So he's talking about whether that can cause or contribute to any kind of gastroesophageal reflux. My answer to that is no. I don't think there's any known contribution.
Okay.
No.
Another question on WhatsApp. Rick says, I'm on Duodart. I think that's medication for BPH condition for many years. That's enlarged prostate. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Can this medication cause ejaculation problems?
Okay. Duodart is basically a medication which is used to treat men with benign prostate enlargement. And it's actually a drug which is a two-in-one drug. So it's a combined drug. One of the medications in the Duodart is called dutasteride. And it basically works by inhibiting testosterone conversion. So from that perspective, it can contribute to reduce ejaculatory volume. It could also potentially in someone who maybe has got borderline testosterone level and then you're suppressing the conversion of that testosterone to the active version of the testosterone or DHT, it could potentially even reduce their libido or sexual desire. As far as ejaculation is concerned, going back to the medicine again, the other component of Duodart is an alpha blocker called tamsulosin. And this is going back to your initial question about retrograde ejaculation. All alpha blockers are known to give a side effect of retrograde ejaculation. So what I'm not very clear at the moment is what kind of ejaculatory problems he's referring to here. Now, if he's saying that he's noticed a reduction in semen during ejaculation or maybe absence of semen during ejaculation, that could potentially be due to retrograde ejaculation. And that's an expected side effect of being on any of the prostate medications, not just Duodart.
Okay. So short answer is possibly yes. And something for you to talk about with your doctor, Rick. Another question is, and this is an interesting one, is going for traditional massage. And this listener has referenced Batin specifically, but I'd also like to talk about any kind of traditional treatments. Can that improve men's health, sexual health, presumably?
Sure. I think with regards to going for this traditional massage or urut batin, I think is what they call in Malay. I don't think there's, I mean, it's something that's been practiced. And I know even in big cities, there are people who actually go to these practitioners and get themselves massaged. I can understand from a physiological or from a medical perspective, I can understand where and how it might be helping because the pressure points where they are doing the massages are sometimes where the nerves that supply the penile tissue and indeed some of the vessels that take the blood to the penile tissue are located. So massaging and stimulating them could foreseeably actually improve blood flow to the penis. And that's what usually they refer to. But In terms of as a prescribed treatment, no. I mean, I've not had any experience of even patients coming to that, although I've heard as such, but I've not come across patients who have gone for these massages and documented improvement.
Okay. So that's the traditional massage or any sort of massage therapy. But there are lots of other traditional and alternative therapies touted to treat, for instance, erectile dysfunction. Right. So what are your thoughts on those?
Okay. My thoughts are basically, you know, men who are seeking treatment for erectile dysfunction, obviously, they're in a bit of a vulnerable state in the sense that they are willing to listen to anyone who can promise them heaven and earth, right? So, unfortunately, there are a lot of unscrupulous people out there. Now, I'm not using the same brush to brush over all herbal traditional treatments, etc. But the problem is discerning which ones are genuine and which ones aren't. There are a lot of people selling potions, tablets, elixirs, mail order online these days. And why I'm basically not in favor of them is basically because in a lot of times what you buy, you do not know what you're getting. In the sense that there's no information regarding its contents. Of course, they would say to you that this is all herbal, plant-based extracts, but there's no way of verifying that. And we have had instances, even in Malaysia, where it was later uncovered the medicine, which was purportedly herbal preparation, turned out to be just basically cornstarch laced with crushed sildenafil. So you have things like that. So you know, so we, that's one thing. And the second part is sometimes it doesn't work. And when you waited so long and you have pinned your hope on some form of treatment that you're hoping that it work, and when it doesn't work, it generally leads to increasing frustration. And that, again, you know, has a negative impact on patients seeking further medical treatment. But the probably the most important thing here, which I'd like to emphasize, is because we know ED is more than just about sexual functioning. If you resorted to mail order medications or maybe other, you know, unconventional practitioners of health, if they do address your problem, they're only going to address you from that perspective. They're not going to advise you to look at this as a global, because I'm not aware of, you know, them asking you to go for fasting sugars, for, you know, fasting cholesterol levels and things like that. So you're kind of missing an opportunity where your body was probably giving you an early warning that something isn't right. And you just got so myopic with just that function alone, and you just seek treatment for that, and you miss the bigger picture.
And which could potentially be dangerous.
Absolutely.
I'll just quickly ask you to address this question. Balan wants to know, is pre-ejaculate normal?
Yeah, I think it's quite normal. I mean, it's to get a clear fluid during sexual arousal, or sometimes even during non-sexual arousal, for example, wet dreams. So, yeah, it's quite normal.
Okay. We're running out of time, unfortunately. But Dr. Siva, could we end on a note of, I guess, looking, if we're looking at male sexual dysfunctions, and if there's any way that men can manage their lifestyles so as to try and prevent, you know, the risk factors that are known to lead to sexual dysfunctions?
Sure. I'm going to sound very boring and very unoriginal in my advice. But
that's always the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the main thing here is going back to the general advice. So basically, eat a balanced meal, watch your weight, quit smoking if you are smoking, because it's not just the lung cancer and the heart disease that you need to worry about. There's a real risk of impotence as well if you continue to smoke. And consume alcohol in moderation, because that we know also suppresses testosterone production. So I think basically living a balanced lifestyle, and least but not least, lead an active lifestyle. Do a bit of sports. Get out there. Keep yourself active. Keep yourself going. It's not just good for the heart. It's good for blood flow all over the body, including the privates.
Okay.
All right.
That was Dr. Siva Pragasam Sivalingam, consultant urologist from Aradamansara Medical Center. We have been discussing male sexual dysfunctions here on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.